Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Have you ever wondered who has the oversight responsibilities for all our doctors, hospitals, pharmacies, big pharma, and all those medications that are going out? Surprise! It's the DEA Diversion Program, and you're about to learn all about it in this week's episodes of Game of Crimes.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the next episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Can't tell you how honored I am that you continue to come back. I bring you the best guest you can find anywhere, and today is no exception. This is a full old friend of mine, and you hear that a lot on here, I know, because I do bring a lot of old friends in. You got to take advantage of your friends. If you can't take advantage of them, what good is it them being a friend, right? But this is an individual that I met in DEA back when we were both assigned to the Special Operations Division. He continued his career long after I did because you can tell he's a whole lot younger than I am. But he's also a Navy veteran. So, I mean, we got a double hitter here. I'm just honored to death to have on and welcome William Bill Matthews. Billy, welcome to the show, brother.
Thanks, Murph. It's great to be here. I appreciate the invite.
Yeah, like we tell all guests after our interview, you and I hope we're still friends. We'll see how it goes today.
I'm sure.
But for our regular listeners, as you know, we have a section here we call a small town police blotter. And before we get into that, I want to give you the disclaimer. This is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things. We talk about bad people doing bad things to good people. You know, we take these stories very seriously, but we're never going to miss an opportunity to have a good laugh at some of these criminals that are out there. And I hit Billy up with this and I asked him, he's in Texas now. So I provided him with a Texas story about a really intelligent criminal down there. Billy, take it away, brother. Tell us about the guy.
Oh, this is a good one. Boy, 12. My son is 13, so this is going to be great. He was arrested after 7:30 in the morning. Car chase. May have been drunk. Texas cops say. That's the header.
12 years old. Jeez.
Well, a 12-year-old Texas boy who led police on a car chase this morning before crashing the SUV, my son would be immediately grounded. he drove it into a utility pole, may have been intoxicated. Oh, there's a twist. According to cops who arrested the child, around 7:30 a.m., a patrolman spotted the suspect's vehicle weaving in and out of traffic on an Austin, Texas street.
Okay.
When the officer sought to pull over the car, the suspect continued driving. He was evading.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's bad. Now let's make it worse.
No, exactly. With the police in pursuit, the fleeing vehicle struck a car traveling in the opposite direction. While that head-on collision did not stop the suspect's flight, the driver subsequently hit a utility pole and rolled his car. The story just keeps getting worse.
That should read, "Roll Daddy's car."
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Grounded for life. It was at the point the police determined that the driver was a child. The boy, who was alone in the vehicle, suffered minor injuries, thank God, and transported to a nearby children's hospital for treatment. God bless children's hospital. They see everything, don't they?
Unbelievable.
The minor is facing several possible juvenile court charges, including driving while intoxicated, already at the age of 12. That's it, right? Failing to stop and render aid and evading police. Due to his age, the boy was not identified by police, who also declined to say who owned the SUV the child was driving. Well, we know it was dad's SUV, and he's probably a little bit more than upset. Yeah.
Man, it makes you wonder, do they have detox for people that age, 12 years old?
You know, I don't know. The fact that we're having to talk about that is kind of concerning that we even have this question, right?
It really is. It really is. And I tell you what, as bad as it was that the 12-year-old was drunk when he wrecked my car, if that had been one of my sons or even my daughters, that's even worse.
You know, just for a second, Murph, when you said when he wrecked my car, I was like, wait a minute, you gave me this story. Is there something you're not telling me?
See, that's a trained criminal investigator picking up there. You got to remember, just like Morgan used to say on here, he used to be my co-host here on the show, words have meanings. And Noah was not one of my kids.
Mm-hmm.
Never lived in Texas.
Not mine. I'm in Dallas.
But I appreciate you doing that, Billy. And now, because I'm in Florida, we're going to read a Florida story, which there are no shortage of Florida stories here.
Yes.
This one, you'll love this one. And it's reference to as Florida Man. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Florida Man that has his own blog. And I'm not sure. I don't think there's a podcast, but there's a lot of stuff if you just look up Florida Man, because there's so many idiot criminals down here.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Florida Man was caught in the act. And the act is the Florida Man botches burglary by accidentally shooting himself in the leg.
Well, that would ruin it.
I guess that's better to shoot someone else. So Florida Man was caught in the act when deputies said he accidentally shot himself in the leg with a stolen gun, alerting the homeowner. Well, first of all, there's a clue that he probably needs to choose a different career path, because it's not working out too good for him being a felon, right?
He's failed. Correct.
The Okaloosa County Sheriff's Office said on the morning of January 4th, several months ago, a woman living near Crestview in the Florida Panhandle called deputies to report a man outside of her house saying he'd been shot. Deputies say they found 28-year-old Justin McCall, we'll call him idiot on here, suffering from a gunshot wound to the leg. He was rushed to a nearby hospital for treatment. Surveillance footage from neighbors caught McCall in the area. Deputies say he was committing a series of car and residential burglaries. The sheriff's office said the gun McCall shot himself with was stolen from another vehicle that he'd broken into. Investigators at the time of the burglary said McCall was out on bond for two separate burglaries. He was also on felony probation for a previous theft of a firearm. And overall, he has 13 felony guilty convictions since 2012 here in Florida, including 6 for burglary, 4 for grand theft,
and one
for a grand theft of a firearm.
Huh.
How is this guy out on bond?
I thought Florida was a little bit tougher. I'm a little surprised. It sounds a little bit like catch and release down there.
It certainly does. It's amazing. The lengths that we go to let the criminals out now, and we wonder why we have a crime problem.
Yeah. Or we don't have a crime problem, depending on who you talk to, right?
Yeah. This idiot's friends.
Exactly.
Oh, man. So that's it for our today's Small Town Police Blotter, everyone. And again, Billy, thank you for playing along on that. Brings a little levity to the show and kind of starts off on a positive foot. So,
I love it.
And like I said, man, there are no shortage of stories. It's just, I'm amazed what comes out of Florida. And it seems like the vast majority of the stories come out of Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater, over in that area. I don't know what's going on over there, but I guess with the hurricane, they're trying to wash them all away again.
How you doing down there with that hurricane? Everything all right?
Yeah, we were good. Helene, thankfully for us, hung a left and went up to what they call the Big Bend there in Florida, going out into the Western Panhandle. My kids, I've got 2 of my 4 kids live in Atlanta with their families, and they actually had it a lot worse than we did. My oldest son lives up there, and they lost power for a couple of days. What's the one that just came through? Milton. That one came, by the time it got to us, it was a Category 1 that did come fairly close to us, but what we had more concerns with was the tornadoes that spawned out of it ahead of the hurricane getting here.
Mm.
So we did have one of those get within probably, I'm going to guess, a mile as crow flies from our house. But we're fortunate, no damage, didn't even lose power. So
you're lucky. Good for you.
Here's the scary thing. We've been here 3 years. That was our 4th hurricane, and we've had 2 severe tropical storms. When I woke up this morning and our son-in-law in Atlanta told us it was 39 degrees there, that just reinforced the reason why I moved to Florida.
Right.
But these hurricanes are getting a little out of control here. So
I agree.
Anyway, just for our listeners here, Billy and I was telling you, we met when we were both in Special Operations Division. At that time, he was in a section we called the Dark Side, and that's a classified operation that we're still not allowed to talk about. I will tell you, it's one of the most successful operations that DEA and other agencies ever had in law enforcement, especially in drug law enforcement. And there was a jackass that fled to Russia who disclosed a lot of that information, which was erroneous information, and resulted in that program being shut down. So do you feel safer? Can you go out on any street corner right now and buy illegal drugs? I could probably go out here, even in my neighborhood, and buy drugs if I just knew the right street corner to go to. So you could tell I've gotten over that, though. I didn't take it personal.
Oh, no, not at all. I couldn't tell.
The hell I didn't.
Yeah, me too.
But then later in Billy's career here, he got promoted and moved out to a staff coordinator position in my old section, which we called OSA, which is the Mexico Central America section. I had the honor of being the ASAC in there for a couple of years before our boss, Derek Maltz, brought me up to be his executive assistant, which I lovingly called his butt boy. But I loved it. It was we had a lot of fun here. And here's one of the interesting things. When Billy and I were talking to start with, just kind of putting some notes together to do today's interview, what I was really interested in is I found out that in Billy's career, he had worked in diversion. And a couple of our regular listeners have contacted me and said, we don't understand diversion. Can you tell us more about that? Can you bring somebody on? So here you go. We brought Billy on today. And one of the cases he worked on, for those of you that have listened for a while, was the Paul Durow claim. If you remember back in episode 37, which was February of 22, we've been going a long time, Billy. I'm in my fourth year here with the podcast. Tommy Cedric was our guest. The man used more F-bombs than anybody else ever has on this.
And, yes, he did.
And that's just Tommy. Billy here worked the diversion side of that. And you'll understand that a little bit better once we get into him telling them, you know, what diversion is, what the responsibilities are, some of the cases he's worked on, and that kind of thing. Billy, if you would, the way we kind of start out is give us an idea of where you grew up, what your family was like, you know, brothers, sisters, where you went to school, high school, college, played sports, that kind of thing. We just know a little bit about your background.
Sure. No, I appreciate that opportunity. Born and raised in Scranton, Pennsylvania, home of The Office, before that show ever existed. I'm pretty sure nobody had ever heard of Scranton. Ralph Nader actually referred to Scranton as the armpit of America, and I couldn't disagree with him more. Because
really?
Oh, yeah. No, I love Scranton. Tons of hunting and fishing, and it was a great place to grow up. I am the son of a reverend and a Marine. So mom was a reverend. Father was a Marine. Father, after being in the Marine Corps, went into government service. And my mom now is twice retired reverend. And so long and short of it is, I did my very best never to get caught doing anything, much less driving an SUV in Austin, Texas, and wrapping it around a pole.
Oh, man. I got to tell you, I don't know if I mentioned this to you when we were talking before, but my dad was a minister also.
So
if your mom's a minister and your dad's a former Marine, if your mom catches you, you know your dad's going to break in too, right?
Yeah, exactly right. Maybe that's why my brother and I, because I have a brother, a younger brother, we tried damn hard not to get caught in doing anything that you would know that teenagers would do. And we were effective, but there were occasions, Murph, where we did get caught. And I'm not sure which was worse, the psychological beating or the latter, right? So yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my dad didn't spare the rod either.
Mm-hmm. So I grew up actually just outside of Scranton in northeastern Pennsylvania, initially on a horse farm. We boarded and raised Appaloosas, and my uncle still, God bless him, he still runs that farm. It's still an active, you know, horse farm. And from there, I graduated from Abington Heights High School, the Comets, in northeastern Pennsylvania. Awesome high school, great experience for sure. And then I went to college. I had a little bit of a trouble trying to find my way. It was hard to compete with my mother, who was a Yale grad and a reverend. And then my father, he was a University of Scranton grad. And I bounced around college. I was into track and field a lot. I went to University of Pitt for a semester, blew out my knee, and then ended my Pitt career immediately. But I ultimately ended up down at the University of Texas in San Antonio and finished up my four-year degree there. Wanted to go back home, so I went back to Scranton, and I went to Marywood University, a Catholic university. At then it was a college. It's now been upgraded to university. And Billy Joel, I'm convinced of it, sung about those Catholic girls, and that's the university he was making reference to, and I don't care what anybody else says.
That's great.
Yep. And then, so I did my four-year degree down in San Antonio. I did my master's at Marywood. And then shortly thereafter, I would start my professional career in the Navy Reserves and everything else.
Yep. How did you choose UTSA?
I thought I would get back into track and field. And so they had a developing program. It was D2. It was recognized. The university was great. I wanted a change. A Pennsylvania boy, I just wanted to do something different. And I just really picked Texas. And I wanted to go to San Antonio. I wanted to go explore. I wanted to do something different.
San Antonio is a beautiful place. That's where Javier lives, Javier Pena. Good place. And then I think you got your degree there in political science and government. And your master's was in
public administration with a concentration in criminal justice. And my political poli-sci degree really didn't serve me well, but the public administration degree really did. I was able to put thoughts to paper and sound somewhat a little bit articulate. So, yeah, it was good.
Hey, everybody's used to me, and you hear my accent, you know where I'm from. Let me tell you, you're a breath of fresh air on here. So how did you get interested in the Navy? Were you in ROTC in school? Or?
No, it's kind of interesting. I think I did it out of defiance. My father was that Marine. I was trying to go into the military. And I'll tell you a kind of a quick story. I initially tried to go into the Army, Murph, and I could not get into the military to save my life. Why? I was allergic to bees. So I kept getting denied due to a medical. Well, I would ultimately go to John Hopkins Medical, the John Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And I underwent a study, and they stung me with live bees after 2 years of being treated so that to build up an immunity to bee stings. So I was heck bent and serving in the military. And I spent years trying to get in.
Wow.
And they literally kept me in bed and stung me with live bees. And I had some reactions, but then not enough. And finally, I would get into, by this time, my life was developing a little bit. So I chose the reserves. So I joined the Naval Reserves, and I was assigned to Fleet Hospital, right on the border of Scranton and Wilkes-Barre. Really, the place where I served was the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre-Avoca International Airport facility. It was right next to that airport. Big, gigantic name for a tiny little airport.
Uh-huh.
But it was really just to serve. I just wanted to serve any way possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I picked this, and then I was finishing college, and I was like, okay, DEA would come knocking. And that was another way for me to serve. And I didn't have to get stung by live bees. So it was great.
I've heard of people making sacrifices to get in the military, but haven't heard that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, your dad being a former Marine, were you giving him this when you joined the Navy?
He was pissed. Yeah.
How long was he in the Marine Corps?
He was in for about 6 years, mm-hmm. 4 to 6 years with IRR and whatnot. So 4 years he served. The one place I do recall that he served was 29 Palms. That was when I was a youngster, for sure.
Yeah. That's funny because you hear the jokes between the Marines and the Navy, and everybody knows the Marine Corps is part of the Navy, whether they want to admit it or not. But if you ask a Marine, they just say they use the Navy for transportation until they get to the real battle.
Mm-hmm. That's it. And trust me, I heard all of these things that I was lesser than dad for a while. It was funny. It was all tongue in cheek.
Yeah. What about your brother? Did he go to the military?
No. He went a different path. He went into just all things retail. I thought he was pretty cool when he ended up being a manager at a Victoria's Secret.
Okay.
And then he bounced around to Eddie Bauer, and now he's working for a Texas-based grocery chain. He's in mid-level management. He's with HEB here in Texas.
Yeah. You know what? Not everybody, but even this country redneck here knows what HEB is.
Great barbecue, y'all.
Yeah. Javi and I spoke at a Robbery Investigators of Texas conference a couple of months ago in where do we go? Fort Worth. There's this big man walking around, and so you go around and they have a little get together for all the vendors that are there. So we all go to a bar one night, and somebody, one of the companies, sponsored all the food and the alcohol for everybody. And you go around, introduce yourself to people, get to make new friends that way. And this guy was one of the big shots in HEB. We're like, hey, bring us in to speak to your employees. Well, we have a speaking business, so if you listen to that, brother, and I'm sorry I don't remember your name, but hey, bring us in. I'm not joking.
And I'll tell my brother. Maybe he knows him.
Yeah. It's the whole goal here is the Murphy clan does not have to eat cat food in retirement. That's what I'm shooting for here. All right. So then is there anybody else in your family in law enforcement?
Going back in generations. And I mean on both sides. Both sides of my mom and dad's, they had military and or law enforcement. So Army Air Corps, Marine Corps, Scranton PD. My great-grandfather was a paddy wagon driver.
Cool.
Yeah, no, he was, you know, a larger man than myself with blonde hair and blue eyes. He stood at apparently anywhere from 6'3 to 6'4. He passed away shortly after my birth. But he was a no kidding, real deal paddy wagon driver. And so, so I really grew up with photos in the house and stories, you know, of people that were serving, you know, within, you know, the military.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, that law enforcement touch. So that, and then, as I mentioned, my father was no different. Mm-hmm. So that stuck with me for sure. That was a driving force.
Was there an, so this kind of sounds like a loaded question, but I'll tell you why I ask it. When I was about 10 years old, me and some of my buddies got picked up by the cops trying to break in the house one night. So I was on that thin blue line. I could have gone left as easily as I went right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it sounds like you might have grabbed an SUV. You're only one step short.
But I think that might be the motivating factor which got me interested in law enforcement, because I wanted to be a cop since I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. Was there an event in your life that maybe made you think that's something I'd like to try?
It was drugs.
Was it?
It was drugs. Like, so I'd love to tell you that on both sides of my family, we had all of these individuals that were just superstars in the military.
Hey, everybody, if you picked up on a little static there, we had a little technical difficulty there that Murph is not quite smart enough to figure out. So we just stopped and restarted here, but we got through it. And we were just talking, Billy, about an event. Was there an event in your life that maybe made you think, hey, I want to be a cop?
Yeah. And I will tell you, there absolutely was. There were several. There were quite a few, but it all surrounded around matters related to drugs. And now, no shocker, that's why I became a DEA agent. I did have a lot of people that served the military and or law enforcement on both sides of my family, but there were others that struggled with that of addiction. And I don't just mean marijuana. Heroin was, you know, a drug of choice. Coke, mostly, if I had to pick the top three. I saw a lot of coke, heroin, and marijuana, and if I had to pick another one, even LSD. It was riddled within my extended family, and I saw a lot of that within some of my friends as well. And, you know, you joked, Murph, and, you know, and I can joke too, that there was a point in my life that I really could have banked hard left.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I found myself following the Grateful Dead and during one summer, and I found one of my relatives, you know, got picked up by a three-letter agency for doing something that they shouldn't have with drugs. And I think it was a wake-up call for me. I started going, I'm going to go and I'm going to try to serve. And I thought that was a good, solid course for somebody like me to give me direction and to prop me up and to maybe even tear me down to build me back up and to make sure that I didn't end up to be a statistic, much like the ones we're struggling with right now as a country, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it was definitely all things drugs surrounded by it. And even now, even after my career now, when I go back home and I go back to Scranton, I still see some of the extended family, and I still see how some even generational gaps where mm-hmm. they still struggle with these drugs. And so I can tell you that through that experience coupled with DEA and things that I see after DEA, I know what addiction looks like.
Yeah.
For sure.
Javier and I have had the opportunity over the past several years to, we joined up with a lobby company out of San Francisco that represents pharmacies and pharmacists, not big pharma. And the whole goal was to bring awareness to counterfeit medications.
Hmm.
So in that role, one year we spoke to the, we went to Congress twice. One year was to speak to the House side. The next year was to speak to the Senate side. And then we spoke to the American Legislative Exchange Conference one year in Austin, Texas, as a matter of fact, where all 50 states have legislators present, and which is a huge party, but hopefully they get something good done. It was amazing how many of our lawmakers at federal and state level had no clue that counterfeit medications was even an issue. And this was before COVID, so it's not modern. It's not so much modern day, but it's not so much historically too far back either. Even one guy, I won't name the state, but came to us. He's a former police officer, and you know, he came up and met us. And I mean, the lobby company's capitalizing on the fact that we have Narcos behind their name with Netflix and all that stuff. And that's
sure.
fine, because we're still trying to achieve a purpose.
Sure.
But one of the things that we told everybody, he said he had no clue. He was shocked as much as anybody else.
Right.
But what we're trying to do is get the word out that this is a problem. And then as painkillers and what we're going through now, even with fentanyl,
sure,
a lot of people want to sit back and say, that really doesn't affect me. And I've told every audience I spoke to that'll listen to me, let me give this little speech, that if you think it doesn't affect you, you need to look closer, because I can almost 100% guarantee you there's somebody in your circle that is having a problem. You just may not know about it.
100%.
It was amazing. We were doing a fundraiser for, I don't know if you ever knew Mike Chapman with DEA.
Oh, of course. Yeah, the sheriff, sure, in Loudoun.
Yeah. So he brought us in. We were doing a fundraiser for him at a nice winery there in Loudoun County, Virginia, a couple years ago. And there was a state representative there. And I won't mention their name, but afterwards they came up and whispered in my ear, because I've got an immediate family member who has a pill problem.
Yeah.
And that person, that legislator, came up to me and whispered out of my ear and said, you're not alone. It does affect all of us. And they told me about the person in their family that it affects. And this is just a message out to our listeners here. It's widespread. The efforts that we're taking to try to address it are not working. I mean, we might be making a little progress, but you look at Derek Maltz, who's taken the initiative.
He's amazing.
The lead. He is. He's fantastic. The people mm-hmm. he's representing. I just saw him again on the Dr. Phil show, where Dr. Phil has taken the stance against all the overdose deaths here in the United States. Thank goodness. So I'm getting off topic here, but it's something that you and I both are passionate about. We've got to do something.
Listen, I agree with you. I remember, one of my first assignment, or my first real assignment after I came out of the academy, I went to Scranton for a couple of months. I owed some time back to the Navy Reserves because I was away at the academy. I went into L.A. I reported to the Los Angeles Field Division, and I was assigned to the LAPD Major Narcotics Group. Back then, Murph, to your point, the amount of overdose-related deaths was around 14,000 people per year.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, being young and younger and with a big shiny badge and a Glock 22 40 cal at my side, I thought I was going to bring that number down to zero all by myself, right? Mm. And back then, there was a point in a lot of us, we would talk and say, maybe we can target, the dealers that led to the individuals that were overdosing in our areas of responsibility. And it was clever. I mean, back then, it seemed like manageable. You would be able to find an overdose death and then subsequently work those cases up if that's what you so choose, and feel like you were making a difference. But now, Murph, to your point, and Derek Maltz's point, who drives us home almost daily, you can't get away from him on the news. It's funny, but he's right. And we're losing now, instead of 14,000, we're losing now the equivalent of a mid-sized United States city mm-hmm. in and around 110,000 souls per year. Mm-hmm. Like, I never thought in my career that I would have begged to go back to 14,000. And I looked at a chart recently that was provided by the CDC. It looks like a tsunami, the way the graph just keeps going up and up and up. And I remember that sense that watching 14,000, Murph, I remember going, each year it was going up. And I was like, why isn't it going down? Mm-hmm. And each year I remember going, it's a crescendo. It's going to be that wave that crashes upon the shores, and then it'll go back down to 14,000 or below. But Murph, there was only a short blip during the era of like COVID, and now it just continues to go up. I'm hearing this year for the first time it may go down, and I hope it does. But what is that going to look like? What's it going to go down to 100? Is it going to go down to 70?
Mm-hmm.
I gave a lecture in Annapolis that has anywhere from 30 to 40,000 souls. And I actually gave it at the coolest place ever. It was the Navy Marine Corps Stadium. And I gave this speech, and I remember going, my gosh, we're losing 110,000 people. That's the equivalent of losing like 3 to 4 Annapolises per year.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's scary, right?
Absolutely. There was, I was up in New York City one time doing a fundraiser up there for the DEA Educational Foundation. And I heard a gentleman get up, and this analogy sticks with me to this day. And this is a simple way. I'm a visual person. I've got to see things to understand them. And this puts it all in perspective. What if a major airline carrier crashed in our country every single day of the year, killing? We're having over 300 overdose deaths per day.
I know it.
What would the reaction be if a jetliner crashed every day in our country? You know what it would be. We would stop air transportation. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
But yet we're having all these, the equivalent of 300 plus souls, Americans dying every day in our country. And you got our lawmakers are back. We got to do something. We got to do something. Yeah, you got to do something. Get off your lazy ass and do your job.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
And it's not just them. My biggest pet peeve is how we are becoming so permissive in our country that it's okay for anybody to do anything. Let's legalize all these drugs. We saw that in Washington and Oregon. We're now seeing them starting to reverse their decisions out there, realizing that wasn't the smartest thing, which I think everybody else could have figured that out. But even the legalization of marijuana, and I know this is a touchy subject with a lot of people, our regular listeners know what my position is. I'm against it completely.
Absolutely.
If you think it's going to stop the Mexican cartels from bringing marijuana or growing marijuana in our country, it's laced with toxic chemicals.
Yeah.
And you think they're not going to put a little fentanyl in there to give you a better reaction? Does it kill you? Hell yeah, it'll kill you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sorry to get off on a tangent here, but I get somebody sympathetic on here with me and I can go, man.
No, listen. I mean, it's something that when I lecture and when I talk, I promise everybody in the audience that I'll keep talking if you just keep each other safe and watch over one another and call it out and hold people accountable.
Yes.
You're right, Murph. I mean, listen, it's okay that you made a mistake, but you should be held accountable. And that being held accountable may very well save your life or somebody else's life.
Right.
100% agree with you, Murph. 100%.
I was looking for his episode number. We had a guest on here, John Norez, who was with the California Wildlife Officers, started the marijuana interdiction program where they're going up in the remote mountains attacking these illicit grows by the Mexican cartels. It's phenomenal. Back when California was suffering from the big water drought, he's got a fantastic book. He talks about how billions of gallons of water were diverted at a time when Southern California was rationing water. And it was all being diverted to grow illegal marijuana up in the mountains of California. And then he talks about how the legislatures out there are manipulated by the criminals. It's an amazing book if you haven't listened to that episode, and I'm not seeing it here, but his name is John Norez. In fact, I had him on again after I saw him last year at the California Gang Conference, and he's doing some things on the Indian tribal lands now, trying to help them out. Just fantastic. But let's get back to you. I can't let it go. It's just, I'm sorry that children are being killed from these poisonings, overdose, whatever you want to call it. But why are our children taking those to start with? Who do you point the finger at? I don't know. I wish I had the answers. All I have is a bitch that I bitch about as often as I can.
But it's scary, Murph. I mean, it's a valid topic. Like, I have a 13-year-old boy. I have a 15-year-old girl. And I know what's going on in these schools. I know how prevalent fentanyl is. I know that when you listen to our friend Rocky, you know, who's a retired agent out of San Diego, preach to the kids and teach to the kids that they're color coding the fentanyl to make it look like Skittles. Well, who do you think they're targeting? They're not targeting you and I, right?
Yeah.
And then you couple that with DEA stats that one pill can kill that program, and 7 out of 10 have a lethal dose that can take out our children. Like, I'm scared to death when my kids go to school that they're going to do something stupid one time, and then that costs them their lives. And you know, that's scary. It's not the peer pressure. The peer pressure might be the same that when you and I were growing up, even though we're, you know, you're a little bit older, I'm sure it was very similar. And maybe the peer pressure is the same now, Murph, but the stakes are higher.
They are.
One pill can kill. Come on.
And it's not even a pill. We've got a good friend that went to Capitol Hill with us a couple of times, and we stay in touch with her. And her son took a quarter of a Xanax, and he had a legitimate reason. He had hives. And he was just trying to get some relief. But instead of getting it through a doctor's prescription, he got one from a friend who had gotten it off the street. And he took a quarter of a Xanax that was laced with fentanyl and never woke up.
And to your point, Murph, like when I was in Dallas, we were seizing pill presses with the punches. This is the counterfeits that you were talking about to make it look like the M30s, the Oxys and the Roxys and the bars and the Xanax bars and everything else. They try to make it look legit, but it's not.
Yeah.
Right? It is a problem.
It is. Yes. Okay, everybody. Thanks for bearing with us on that. On our Patreon side, we're going to do an episode about legalization of marijuana, and that will probably drift off into me ranting and raving again. But if you're not on Patreon and you're interested in that, come on over to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and join the bitch session with me. There you go. All right, so you apply for DEA.
Yeah.
And what year did you go to the academy?
98.
Okay. And what was your class number?
BA 125.
You go, brother. You go.
Mm-hmm.
I was BA 53.
You go.
I think I was BA 30. But when you went through, were you at the DEA Academy or the FBI Academy?
So we were the last class or the second to last class, one of them, that go through the actual FBI Academy. The DEA Academy was being constructed and, you know, that was just a big mud ball at the time. So yeah. FBI for sure.
Yeah.
It was fun though.
So I asked this from everybody that goes through, especially the DEA Academy. While you were there, did you have to write any memos?
Couple.
Me too.
Yeah, no, I had a couple. I had a problem shooting straight. So basically, it was like writing my name 1,000 times on the chalkboard. So a couple of times. Yeah.
My first memo was I was been a cop for 12 years, and I'd been on a shooting team. I was a railroad cop at that time and city cop and railroad cop. And we were traveling all around the country in these shooting competitions. I was a very good shot. So they put you on the 5-yard line. Back then we had revolvers and it was slow fire. And they're like, all right, slow fire, try to hit that piece of paper in front of you at 5 yards. Well, 5 yards, I could pretty much make one hole. One of the instructors comes up and says, hey, smartass, when I go to score this, that counts as one. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. What am I supposed to do? And he's like, if I can't count the hole, you don't get credit for it. So
sure.
next time I put one here or two here and spread them out. He's like, oh, that's real funny. That's real funny. Write me a memo on what? Why you want me to not be a good shot? And so it got worse because I couldn't keep my mouth shut. But
I didn't have your skill set. Remember, I grew up hunting in northeastern Pennsylvania. So I was looking for the buck for opening day of buck season with a rifle and a shotgun. I was great with a rifle and a shotgun. Murph, I couldn't hit the side. I couldn't hit that piece of paper from 5 yards with a handgun to save my life. So I was doing the dime drill. I don't know if you did those dime drills with the red handles. And you didn't want the dime to fall off your front sight. And and apparently I wasn't drilling enough. And so they were just like, just start writing memos. Just start writing. Eventually I caught on and it clicked, but it was ugly. It was ugly. Yeah.
I got to tell you, that dime drill, I think I'm the one that introduced that.
No way.
We had several people in our class that were having a hard time qualifying. And so the instructors, I mean, they knew my past. And they're like, listen, you got red handles in the room. You are now in charge of them to teach them how to squeeze that trigger, not yank the trigger. All the different little techniques that you use there. And so I started that dime drill, and they started improving with that. The instructor's like, what'd you do? And I told him that. So I guess it kind of carried on. You're the first person to ever say that.
Listen, it was awesome. I won't belabor it. Whereas you remember how the instructor was telling you, I'm going to count your 5 shots as one. I was praying for one. I was so bad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But at the end, it worked. I mean, that dime drill, I owed everything to it. That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, and they got some fantastic instructors up there. That's
of course.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. No, the instructors were top notch. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, when you were ready to graduate the academy, did you guys back then, did you still have to submit a wish list where you wanted to go?
Yeah, and I didn't get anything on my wish list.
What'd you put in for?
Anything other than Los Angeles. Yeah. I remember saying, I'll even go to the border. I know a little bit of Spanish because I spend time in San Antonio. And they're like, nope, you're going to Los Angeles.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Did you piss somebody off or what?
It probably came back to the dime drill and the memos, Murph.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, I can imagine that's culture shock coming from a small town of Pennsylvania. You know, that'd be like me coming from a small town of West Virginia going out there.
I went from like small town USA background in horse ranch, suburbia, that kind of environment to welcome to LAPD majors. And your first warrants are going to be in Gardena and Compton. Go.
Yeah. And Compton has a reputation.
It does. It did back then, and I assume it still does,
yeah,
for sure.
Well, mm-hmm. You've seen those TV shows, Straight Outta Compton.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've never worked in L.A. other than just temporarily, but you were assigned to the HINA group out there, right?
Yeah, the high-intensity drug trafficking area. So I was assigned to HIDA 51. HIDA 51 was made up of all LAPD and one DEA agent, and then myself, because nobody counted me as anything at that point. I was just a boot. And my FTA was Michael Allen, and my D3 and was Eddie, and I had a D1, Dave Torres and Eddie and the LAPD guys. And see, talk about like just an awesome D3s and D1s. They're all detectives and everything in between. And they were all seasoned veterans. So many of them had so many lifelong lessons because they served for 20, 30 mm-hmm. years.
Yeah.
You know, they were just amazing. They served in the riots. This was my first group and it was brutal, but I learned a ton.
Oh, yeah.
They were salty as hell.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You learn about that. Nothing's off the table. They could bust your stones about anything.
and they did. Right down to the first second that I walked through the door for the first time, you know, I just won't forget like the first moments where you're just like so green and so new and you didn't know LA and, you know, and you're just learning your jobs. And just getting tortured by those guys was a fun ordeal for sure.
Yeah. But that's probably some of the best learning you could have ever gone through. The best, you know, especially for a newbie coming on the job. You learned from these old salty guys?
100%. I drew a picture for you. Is it okay if I show you a picture?
Sure.
So my FTA, Mike, he comes in, he goes, hey, you're late. And I had to explain the whole I owed the Navy time. And he's like, yeah, I don't care.
Yeah. And I know Mike Allen. He's funny.
Right. He's like, I don't care. And he goes, he looks at me and he goes, you know what? We're going to call you Beaver. You look like that kid from Leave It to Beaver. And I'm like, oh, Jesus.
Here we go.
And he goes, I would love to talk to you and kick your ass a little bit, but the boss is waiting for you in the room. He wants you to explain as to why you're so late, meaning like I was a couple of weeks behind.
Yeah.
And so he's salty. Eddie Gutierrez. Love the guy. He was definitely in Mike, too. They were like mentors. But I go into the office and he's like, I didn't ask for you to sit down. Mm-hmm. Right. And I said, OK, sir. And you see, I have the board ready for you. And he had an eraser board here, and on the eraser board was this right here. I don't know if you can see it.
Yeah.
It's two dots, and it looks like, you know, parentheses. Do you see it?
Yep, got it.
He goes, hey, kid, this is you. And I said, okay, yes, sir, it's me. Like, what am I going to say? He goes, do you see these two little dots? I go, yes, sir. He goes, those are your eyes. You watch me. You watch me. And I go, yes, sir. Do you see these two parentheses looking things? Uh-huh. I go, yes, sir, I do. He goes, those are your ears. You notice how big they are. You will listen to me and only me. And I'm like, yes, sir. Yes, sir. He goes, kid, did you notice I didn't give you a mouth? Sorry. So to say
it. I love it.
I learned a ton from those guys, David Torres and Ruben and Rose, all of them. They're just wonderful, wonderful people.
Mm-hmm. Was that your GS? Was that a DEA GS or LAPD?
LAPD.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, there was no rest for the wicked with that man. That's for sure.
And see, that's the cool thing I love about DEA, because you come on as a task force officer. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you're a second grade police officer. Here, the guy is the actual group supervisor. He's a first line mm-hmm. supervisor, raking mm-hmm. you across the coals, telling you what's expected of you. I know it's a pain in the butt to go through at the beginning, but
best years. And you know, for anybody that's LAPD listening, I just owe you guys so much. What a top-notch police department, for sure.
They are. We've had a couple of LAPD guys on here. In fact, just interviewed last week Greg Kading, who's retired LAPD. I think his episode comes on next week. And for our listeners, we're recording this one on October 16th. But he's got into the homicide cold case squad and solved the Biggie Smalls murder in L.A. and
wow.
provided information that resulted in the solving of Tupac Shakur. And these are all gangster rappers out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But and had Jamie McBride on here, who's kind of a legend himself out in California, and just good guys out there, man. These guys, when you go meet them in person, they treat you like family. They take you right in.
Cop's cop, for yep. sure.
I love it. I love it. So how long are you in L.A.?
6 years. Yeah, six years. And it was nonstop. It was nonstop for sure.
Were you single at the time?
Partially, yes.
You got married while you were there? Yeah. It's I know it's tough on the family, but man, what a blast going out. That's the way it was in Miami back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Just daily, you're calling your wife, saying, I'm going to be late. I will be late. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'll be home till tomorrow. Those kind of things.
Yeah.
Loved it. And from there, now where'd you go from L.A.?
After working those tractor trailer cases and harbor cases and everything else from L.A., I got asked by the legendary Joe Evans and others to go to the SOD Special Operations Division, to go to the dark side.
Yeah, yeah. How did Joe hear about you?
I honestly think it's just because we were doing a ton of wire cases, surveillance cases with New York City. And actually, it was these wire cases that I had ultimately first be introduced to Derek Maltz. And I was working with task force groups T-12 and T-21 in the New York Field Division, you know, NYPD, the troopers and the DEA agents in New York. And we were just rocking and rolling for at least 2 years. We were just knocking down tractor trailer loads of coke and marijuana and some kilos of heroin here and there. Mostly monster loads of coke, and that's how I presume, because I was writing a lot of wires, doing a lot of surveillance, because LAPD made you do both. There was, you know, like I said, no rest for the wicked. You did all your paperwork and you hit the field, and it was actually during this time where the legendary Michelle Leonhardt was my SAC, and I'd have to brief her every Friday for it was at least 2 years out of those six. Every Friday as to what was going on, because we were just crushing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Michelle was one of our first guests here on the show.
Love her.
I do too. She promoted me up to the SES ranks, and I thought the world of her to start with, but that she's a hero in my eyes.
Mine too.
Yeah. If you've never heard her episode, you really should go back and listen. And I think I can find hers pretty quickly, because she was episode 10, which is August of 21 here on Game of Crimes. And it was... The reason I mentioned that is because here's a small town girl who just wanted to be in law enforcement and couldn't get in because of her height.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she talks about it on the show, and we kind of surprised her when we did her interview too, because she was the mascot for her high school. And so when I put that out there to her, she kind of comes back and she said, how did you know that? I'm like, Michelle, trained criminal investigator. You trained me. Don't you remember?
I love that.
Yeah, she's a hero of my eyes. I love that lady.
Me too.
So now while you're in SOD, when you got involved, had you ever done anything diversion related before you got there?
So before SOD, I actually have a quick story that ended up being diversion related, but it wasn't, it wasn't through normal means. And what I mean by that is we were working the Venice Shoreline Crips at one point, and We were out on surveillance, we being LAPD, and we had a couple of sheriffs in DEA. We're out on the streets, and we were expecting to surveil a cocaine transfer. And it didn't go. Shocker. Sometimes you get out into the streets and things don't go.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in Venice, and we're all pulled into a parking lot, and we all just want to catch up and talk. Some of us haven't actually seen each other for a while. It's in the evening. We're in Venice, and we're just talking. We have our raid jackets on. We have our handhelds out. They're on our cars, and we made our presence known just because we just wanted to talk, Murph,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I was relatively a couple of years on, not much, and I saw this silver car pull up, and then I started seeing the silver car, and they were doing hand to hands like within like 100 meters of us. Like I was like, you got to be kidding me. And you couldn't have a more of a police presence, right? And so I said, hey, I think everybody's like, hey, kid, just like we're trying to talk. And I'm like, okay, so the silver car left and I didn't do anything because I wasn't quite sure. And everybody else is telling me that I wasn't quite sure. Sure enough, Murph, here comes the car back around, you know, 5-10 minutes later, and we're getting ready to wind down. And I went, hey, that's the car. and a couple of people are now paying attention. And sure enough, I see two women come out of this car, and they're dressed to the nines. I mean, complete professionals walking up to the car. I see a hand-to-hand, a couple of this. We see the hand-to-hand, and we all go like this. Oh, God. So Billy's up to no good here. And I started to approach. The silver car took off. We couldn't go get that person quick enough because it just didn't work out logistically. Later, we would find that individual. Doesn't matter. But it's the two ladies. I want to tell you the story. This is my first taste of all things diversion. I'm walking towards the ladies. They now see for the first time there's like 20 of us all in our rain jackets and cars, totally oblivious as to what's going on. As I'm walking towards the ladies, the one lady fills her hand up with what it is that she did earlier. And it was Christmas wrapping paper. I'll never forget it. And she throws it, Murph. She throws it. And where do you think that landed, Murph? On the hood of my car. So I was like, this is going to be an incredibly long night. I can already see Betty, boss, and everybody just rolling their eyes and shaking their head, knowing what's going to happen. Ton of paperwork. But they were all about the greenies, too. And so long story short of it is, they were both pharmaceutical reps, both of them.
Wow.
And one was married to a doctor. And I would find this as we're processing her in. But that would be my first taste of all things related to that of diversion.
Oh, my gosh. What was in the package?
Coke.
Yeah. So there, it was just a few grams?
That's it. It was just enough for the two ladies to get their high on, for sure.
Wow.
Yeah.
We make a joke out of, we a lot of times go after the low-hanging fruit. It doesn't get any lower hanging than that right there.
No, but again, the guys were pissed because it tied them up into like all hours of the morning.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That paperwork's a little bit overwhelming at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So on the dark side, did you do any diversion related there, or was that after you got to be a staff coordinator?
So really, the dark side, no diversion there, and that was classified, and that I would be bumped up to OSA, or the unit that handles all things cartels. And if you're interested, I can show you what that might look like. I have something on my wall. Do you want to see that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let's see this.
So during my time with them, during my time there, we created a deck of cards targeting all cartels. And this right here represents all of the leadership of all the cartels, the Mexican cartels that were operating, around 2006 to 2009 in there. And some names like Chapo Guzman and Gilberto Lascano. But there were some big names here, for sure.
Yeah. That is cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. That is very cool.
Yeah. Love
it. Why did my guys come up with that when I was there in OSA?
The smarter, quicker, stronger generation followed you, I guess.
I like it. I've never claimed to be the brightest bulb on that Christmas tree. Now, did you get on a diversion case there while you were in the OSA?
No, I didn't. It wouldn't be until after I transferred out of SOD and I went down south for a couple of years.
And where did you go?
So I had a blessed and charmed career. I went to Sao Paulo, Brazil for 3 years.
Not too bad.
Not too bad at all. I had that's actually down there during that time is where I got put onto the Paul LaRue case that you made reference to at the top of the hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How'd you get involved in it? And first of all, just explain for our listeners what diversion is and what it does within DEA.
Sure.
Please.
So there are four core series that DEA has. Agents, all about, and diversion investigators, intelligence analysts, and chemists. Diversion investigators are your non-gun toters. They are indeed the regulatory arm of the Drug Enforcement Administration. They oversee the nearly 2 million DEA registrants that are operating this glorious nation of ours. A DEA registrant can be your local CVS has a pharmacy. There's a registration there. It could be a McKesson, a Cardinal, a manufacturer, a distributor of controlled substances or controls, I call them. It could be a hospital. A hospital has a DEA registration number, at least one. They might have an inpatient, pharmacy and an outpatient or retail pharmacy. So a canine handler, Murph, can be a DEA registrant. So There's nearly 2 million DEA registration numbers at any one point in time now in the United States. And there's only approximately 700 DIs. And everybody that's listening to this podcast always is thinking, much like ourselves, that we're, you know, short-staffed and overworked and underpaid.
Yeah.
But think about the odds, 700 versus 2 million states, you know?
Wow.
They enforce the rules and regulations put forth in the Code of Federal Regulations. And I happened, you know, to guess that you might bring up diversion. So the Code of Federal Regulations.
Show them how thick that book is.
Well, just the 1300 section is 300 pages plus front and back of fine print. It's written with a fundamentalist eye before Al Gore invented the internet. And I got to tell you, it's a tough read. And so, but this is where the four corners are. If you're a diversion, if you're a drug diversion investigator, this is where your four corners are. So the job is so, I know they're not gun toters, but it's so very important. I mean, it would be the wild, wild west without the CFR and DEA when it comes to all things controlled substances. And so that's, they try to keep everybody safe, and you operate underneath the Controlled Substance Act. And if you're a doctor or a nurse or a pharmacist or anybody that has a DEA registration number that can give a prescription, that's a position of trust, just like you and I used to be in a position of that of trust. And so they watch over and help those individuals to stay within those four corners of the CFR.
Only the government can come up with that much documentation. I was just thinking in my mind, if you took all of the CFR, and we've all heard, it's amazing. All heard of the book War and Peace and how thick that is.
Yeah.
That if you stacked up the CFR next to War and Peace, it would make the War and Peace book look like a dime store novel book, the Western novel that you can read in you know, a couple hours. It's amazing. And we wonder why things are so complicated within the government.
Yeah. Well, that's a good reason as to why. I mean, and if you read it, there is not enough coffee or time in the world to sit through that thing and read it from one end to the other. It's brutal. It's very regimented, for sure.
It is. It's ridiculous. A lot of it is needed. I will grant you that.
100%.
If you're going to hold people to specific rules, they need to know what those are. But it just seems like you could, I don't know, somehow reduce that BS, all the BS that's in there. I'm sure there's a lot of wordy language that's not really necessary. And of course, our lawyers are the ones that create it. So that in itself makes it ambiguous, gives you, I'm not going to say loopholes, but something that a good defense attorney can look at and say, well, this is the way I interpret that. So what a mess. What a mess. And since that time, I want to touch on based on this, because we're going to talk about it here shortly, eventually DEA came up with what we call tactical diversion squads.
Yes.
Right? And you remember one of those, right?
Yes. So a tactical diversion squad, TDS, I was a group supervisor in the Dallas Field Division for several years in which I ran a TDS group. And the TDS group was made up of really outstanding individuals, drug diversion investigators, agents, state and local authorities, police. We had Texas troopers, and we had local PD officers on that TDS at that time. It was a melting pot of awesome investigators that would go and target a DEA registrant that went off the reservation, either criminally or civilly. You know, those charges would be put forth against those individuals.
And those guys, would it be fair to say that they bring the armed faction to the diversion investigations when needed?
Absolutely. So they would do the surveillance and the execution of the search warrants and the preparation of the search warrants. Absolutely. And they would bring the handcuffs and guns if needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And certainly not taking anything away from our diversion investigators.
No.
They are dedicated individuals that do a fantastic job. I would hate to be on the regulatory side where you had to go look at their, say, a pharmacy's records or even a doctor's records and count the number of pills.
I'll tell you, you know, Murph, back when I was and this is one of the reasons why I ended up, or how I ended up really developing somewhat of a passion for all things diversion. On a personal note, and I don't mind sharing it, when I was in Brazil, my son underwent open heart surgery. And when he was born in Sao Paulo, Brazil, during his first year of birth.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was when I was wanting to become a DEA agent, I know we described this earlier as to the why. But that shifted when I started developing this. We all appreciate the healthcare sector.
Hey, players, that's the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, just a reminder that Game of Crimes is now posting interview videos on YouTube. You can find those at Game of Crimes Podcast. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com, where you'll find all our episodes, our guests, book lists, merchandise, and more. And for more content, join us on patreon.com/gameofcrimes. I have several monthly episodes that range from silly to serious, so come on over and join the fun. In the meantime, everyone stay safe. I'll see you tomorrow for part two.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.